Welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha, a podcast shared by David Roylance. This podcast is dedicated to guiding you to completely eliminate the discontent mind and the suffering it causes by attaining enlightenment. Learn and practice the teachings of Gautama Buddha that will guide you to fully attain a peaceful, calm, serene, and content mind with joy. To support this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha or visit buddhadailywisdom.com, where you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online learning resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Now, here's our teacher to share more.
Sawadee krap. Hello and welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha. Today is our group learning program and we're studying chapter 23 in our book, Developing a Life Practice, The Path That Leads to Enlightenment. This chapter is titled Symbolism of the Teachings, Reminders Through Imagery. This is where you learn about some of the artwork and some of the symbolism that's embedded in Buddhist things, whether it's a temple, whether it's artwork or other things that you might see. There's certain symbolism that is used throughout the Buddhist world. And if you understand this symbolism, it'll really help you to be able to further glean understanding of the teachings of the Buddha and really deepen your understanding of the teachings of the Buddha. Because during the Buddha's lifetime, everything was taught orally and they used symbols in order to remind the students of his teachings so that they could then commit them to their memory and then practice them and actually experience the results of the enlightened mind. So I'd like to welcome you to our class today. I'm going to help you to learn all the various symbolism that you'll see, at least a lot of the more general ones that you'll see more readily. And one of the reasons why it's helpful for you to understand this symbolism is not just because it's something that they used during the lifetime of the Buddha, but these things are actually in use today as well. If you go around to Buddhist temples or you look at Buddhist artwork or you visit various venues or even you just read books, oftentimes you'll see various symbolism from the teachings of the Buddha. And this is really helpful for you because it should remind you of the teachings. And now that we've gotten all the way into the group learning program where we're coming towards the end and we'll be restarting on March 17th, this is a good time to now take the things that you've been learning and now help you to see the symbolism of the teachings. Because during the lifetime of the Buddha, he taught everything orally. The technology to write things down didn't exist in the region of the world where he lived. It was all in China, pretty much. 2,500 years ago, the entire world didn't actually read and write and have even script for certain languages because the technology to write things down hadn't made its way throughout the world yet. It was in China, but it hadn't made its way to the region of the world where the Buddha lived, which was northeast India in Nepal. This is what we call it today. So as that technology started coming in, of course, by the time the Buddha died, after his death, they were able to start writing things down. But during his lifetime, everything he taught was oral. The language that he used didn't even have a script because there was no need to have a script because there was no way to write it down and those people weren't aware of any way to write things down. We might consider these people illiterate today because they didn't read and write, but that doesn't mean that they were unaware or they didn't know things or they weren't smart or intelligent. It's just that they didn't have the technology, so they had no need to use a script for their language. This is the reason why the Buddha used chanting during his lifetime, because he would teach orally, and then every 2 weeks, they would recite his teachings word for word for word. So there's no prayer or rites or rituals or ceremonies or worship as part of the teachings of the Buddha. Instead, as he taught throughout his life, and you would sit in a discourse with him and learn his teachings, then he would use various symbols in order to remind you of the teachings. And those symbols are things that I'm going to be sharing with you today so that when you see these symbols, it can remind you of the teachings, much like it reminded people during the lifetime of the Buddha. And one of the things that they've done here in Thailand is over the last 800 to 1200 years, they've created temples all throughout the country. There's over 30,000 temples here throughout Thailand. And one of the things that the Thai people do is they travel around and they tour these different temples. So if you're from one region of Thailand and you go on holiday to another region of Thailand, you might make it part of your holiday to kind of tour some temples. And as you tour the temple, if you understand the symbolism of the things that are being used by the artist, the temple kind of speaks to you. It kind of comes alive because these people who created these temples, sometimes they're 500 years old, 800 years old, 1,000 years old. As you see these various artworks, you can kind of see what was the artist really saying to you? What was the artist trying to communicate? And this is a great way to go through the temples and really glean information. And this is a pastime that the Thai people do. And when they're on their holiday and they visit various temples, they might give a little bit of money here or there to help them with the water and the electric and things like this. And it helps to support this network of temples all throughout the country. This network of temples, the way that I think about it, is I think about a temple as a mother's womb. That a womb of a woman is the perfect environment in which a human being can grow and develop and become a human being. The same thing is true about a monastery or a temple. It's the perfect environment in which an individual can enter into and grow and become a better and better human being. So what you see in these temples is you see a cultural center, you see a learning center, a place where people can grow and people can develop. As they grow and develop in these different learning centers, there's the ability to interact with teachers or ordained practitioners, people like me that are there teaching in classes, but you can also talk with people privately too on a one-on-one basis. And one of the ways to think about a temple is not only this womb of a woman where an individual can grow to become a better and better human being, but you can also think about the network of temples all over Thailand as a mental health network. It's essentially a self-funded, self-created mental health network where people all throughout Thailand, whether you're Thai or you're from another country, you can enter into a temple environment and potentially find somebody that can help you with your mental health. Because the teachings of the Buddha are to eliminate anger, sadness, frustration, irritation, annoyance, guilt, shame, fear, boredom, loneliness, shyness, resentment, jealousy, even the slightest displeasure is eliminated from the enlightened mind. You'll have focus, concentration, clarity, deep memory. You'll notice your personal and professional relationships really blossom, that you don't have any bitterness and hostility in your relationships anymore. By the time you get to enlightenment, you won't even be in a bad mood anymore. And the way that you accomplish this is through acquiring wisdom, that you interact with resources that share the teachings of the Buddha in his original words. You interact with teachers and go to courses or retreats that will help you to be able to learn and develop your practice of these teachings to purify your mind of various pollutions that the Buddha discovered. So these temples are there as a learning center, as a cultural center, as a mental health network. And there's various artwork and symbolism all throughout these temples that you can really glean information from if you understand the teachings of the Buddha and you understand these symbols that I'm going to share with you. So I'm going to help you understand some of the very common symbols, and you can ask questions as we go. I'm going to pause at different times and open up to any and all questions that you guys have related to the things that I'm sharing with you today. So as you have questions, if you're in Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, you can put that into the comment section and I'll be able to see that, and then I'll answer your question. If you have a question in Zoom, you can also electronically raise your hand and ask any questions or follow-up questions directly if you would like to do that. So this first symbol that I have to share with you, I refer to it as the Na, but there's other ways to refer to it as well. This symbol in the middle, what it's representing is the path to enlightenment. And this is the very common symbol that you will see throughout the Buddhist world. And then there's others as well. This symbol here is representing your journey to enlightenment. If you think about your journey in all these multiple lifetimes as starting where my pointer is, your life is experiencing, or you as a being, you're experiencing these constant rebirths in this continuous cycle, going around and around and around in this constant cycle. And notice how this path is very wide and it's very dark, right? That's what it's like to be stuck in the cycle of rebirth. It can feel very dark when you're feeling sadness and grief and misery and despair. It can feel very dark. But over time, as you are being reborn over and over and over and over and over again, eventually you start learning the path to enlightenment and you start walking forward. And notice how the path narrows in because you're coming in closer to what the actual teachings are that lead to this enlightened mental state. And as you're making this forward progress, there's going to be backward steps. There's going to be missteps. Sometimes when people think about going to enlightenment or attaining enlightenment, they think of this linear progression, that it's only up, right? But you often have missteps as you're trying to eliminate certain cravings, desires, attachments, as you're trying to train your mind to eliminate harsh speech and speak gentle. You're not going to be able to speak gentle all the time in all situations as you're working towards enlightenment. You're going to have missteps. But as you have those missteps, you would like to use those to cultivate wisdom so that you can then improve. So that then as you improve, then you start making this upward trajectory again. But of course, you're going to have missteps and you're going to come circling back around. And then you're going to continue forward using that wisdom to now propel you again. And now you're going to have more missteps and you look internally, you reflect, you talk to your teacher, you gain resources that can help you to understand where you're having missteps. But slowly but surely, you can see even though you're progressing forward and you're having these backward steps or these missteps, you're narrowing in on the path closer and closer and closer to the point where eventually you come in so narrow that it's a straight line straight to the enlightened mental state. And this occurs through gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress. It's not instantaneous that you would get to enlightenment. It's not just meditation that you would need in order to get to enlightenment. There's other teachings that you need as well. And that's what this group learning program is all about, is helping you to establish the foundational teachings that you need so you can have this framework to understanding the journey to enlightenment. And then we have other programs and courses and retreats that help fill in that framework as well. So this is a very common image that you will see. You might see it placed on statues of the Buddha, the third eye or right between the eyebrows on the forehead, because this represents enlightenment. Or you might see it on various bags or different items or in various artwork. I've seen some people have tattoos of this. I'm not necessarily suggesting you go get a tattoo of this, but I've seen people that do that. So this is a very common one. You'll see this one most frequently. But then because of this impermanence, it's not that everybody uses exactly the same symbol. If you understand what this symbol is, when you run across other symbols that artists are making, because one of the aspects of being an artist is to be creative. So oftentimes artists are creating different things. So these ones that you see on the sides, these are ones that artists created out of their own creativity. But you can see based on understanding the most common one that I'm showing you here in the middle, that the other two on the sides, you can understand those to be the same thing. And by the way, anybody who's listening to this on the podcast, because the podcast is pure audio, you might decide to get a book so that you can actually see the images as I'm describing them. They're in chapter 23. And you can download the book from buddhadailywisdom.com. You can go and print it if you like. You can order printed versions on Amazon, or you can get those here at the temple in Chiang Mai. So this is the image of the Na, and it's representing enlightenment, and it's showing you your journey over multiple lifetimes as you make your way to the enlightened mental state. So let me see what questions you guys might have on this particular image. If you would like to put those into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or if you would like to electronically raise your hand in Zoom, you can ask any and all questions that you like. All right, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere, so I'm going to move on to the next image, which we refer to this one as the Dhamma wheel, but this word Dhamma translates to teachings. The Buddha talks about the Dhamma, and this is his teachings, but the phrase teachings wheel doesn't really sound proper, so I still refer to this as the Dhamma wheel. What this is representing is that if you were in the teachings of the Buddha and you were learning his discourses and you were learning about the cycle of rebirth and how to escape out of that by getting to enlightenment, you would understand what this wheel means. So what this wheel means, this circle here, this circle is reminding you of the cycle of rebirth and constant rebirth over and over and over and over and over again. And that's what each being is actually experiencing. The teachings of the Buddha, they're not based on belief. They're based on you learning, examining, and investigating his teachings, reflecting on those to independently verify them, and then practicing them to uproot pollutions out of your mind and moving the mind closer and closer to this enlightened mental state. So it's not believe, 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 and hope something good happens when you die. This includes the cycle of rebirth. You should never believe the cycle of rebirth. There's ways to actually independently verify that it's true. But when a student's first starting on their journey to enlightenment, I suggest that they set the cycle of rebirth to the side because there's so many other teachings to learn and develop. There's core central teachings like the three universal truths, the four noble truths, the eightfold path, the five precepts, meditation training, and things like this that are really going to impact you and help you in a positive way by removing pollution out of your mind and experiencing more peace and joy. This cycle of rebirth, while it's very intriguing, it's very interesting, and you can absolutely confirm that it's true, what happened in the past, it's in the past. It doesn't matter anymore. And what may or may not happen in the future, it's in the future. It doesn't matter at this point. You're in the human state, and this is the most ideal existence to be in, and you can make your way to enlightenment from this human life. But if you put the cycle of rebirth in front of all your other core central teachings that you need to learn, this can kind of be an obstruction to you in actually learning and getting your arms around the foundational teachings and building this framework for yourself. So I have teachings that I share from the original words of the Buddha that students usually approach those after about a year and a half, 2 years of development. I even have content with 16 items that you can look at in order to independently verify the cycle of rebirth. And if ever there's a time that a student would like that, they can just send me a message or post in the Facebook group and I'll send it to you so that you can see how to independently verify the cycle of rebirth. But again, I suggest for students to do that after they've already dived into the core central teachings and they've gotten their arms around that. But nonetheless, I can confirm that indeed this cycle of rebirth is 100% true and that beings are absolutely stuck in this continuous cycle until they get to enlightenment. And this is part of the teachings of the Buddha. He didn't just slip in the cycle of rebirth into his teachings after telling all this truth and explaining all these truthful things about the world and the natural laws of existence. He didn't just slip in the cycle of rebirth. He's explaining the five realms of existence and what you're experiencing, because as you start lifting out the pollution out of your mind, you might actually start observing your past lives, or you might have communication with beings in one of the five realms, like hell, of course, animal realm, the afflicted spirit realm, of course, the human realm. You have communication with beings in that realm, and even the heavenly realm. You can have interaction with beings in these realms. You can even get to the point where you see beings in these other realms, like hell, afflicted spirit, and heavenly realm, that you might actually see them as you're lifting this pollution out of your mind. So if you experience the recall of past lives, if you start communicating and beings start communicating with you from these other realms, or you start seeing these beings, if you didn't understand the natural laws and that these realms are true, you'd probably think you're going crazy and going insane, and you might find yourself having a lot of problems. So remember, the teachings of the Buddha, they're not a bunch of beliefs, but also he didn't teach the way the world should be, and that if everybody follows these rules, then the world's going to become peaceful. That's not what he did. He didn't teach rules and commandments, and he wasn't teaching the way the world should be. He's teaching you the way the world is. And by explaining the cycle of rebirth and by explaining the five realms of existence, he's explaining the way the world is. And while you may not know how to independently confirm the cycle of rebirth right now, if you don't have the wisdom of how to do that, there's the ability for you to cultivate that wisdom. And as you do, and as students did cultivate this during the lifetime of the Buddha, they started to understand that, yes, they were stuck in this cycle of rebirth. And that's what this wheel is signifying, is this cycle of rebirth, of continuous rebirth over and over and over and over and over again. And then these eight spokes are representing the escape from that cycle of rebirth. They're representing the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is the core central teaching of the Buddha, and you learn this closer and closer as your journey to enlightenment, and you dial this into your life to produce a better and better quality mind and a better quality life. If you could think about a set of speakers and that there's these eight dials, and you would dial these dials in closer and closer to get a better quality of sound out of these speakers, the Eightfold Path is essentially the same thing. You dial these into your life closer and closer, and you'll notice a better and better quality mind and a better quality life. So earlier in this program, I've taught the Eightfold Path at multiple times to ensure that students really understand it. And we're going to be restarting this program on March 17th. And there, when we get started in the program, I'm going to be teaching the Eightfold Path as part of this program, because that's how we really kick off the program, is getting into the core central teaching of the Buddha really closely, called the Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path is the way to escape discontentedness, where you're no longer experiencing that anger, sadness, frustration, and other discontent feelings. And it's also the way to escape the cycle of rebirth, because if you eliminate the causes and conditions that are causing discontentedness, it's also eliminating the potential to be reborn into the world. So this is kind of almost like a two-for-one special, right? If you're accomplishing one goal, you're accomplishing the other. And this is one of the beauties of the teachings of the Buddha, is that you can see the truth for yourself, that your mind is becoming more peaceful and more joyful in this life. So as I mentioned, it's not believe, 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 and hope something good happens when you die. Instead, it's learn now, reflect now, and practice now, so you see the results now in this life. So you know, in situations where you've been angry or frustrated or irritated, and as you're learning and practicing these teachings, developing your mind, training your mind, and you're noticing in those same situations, you're no longer angry or frustrated or bitter or harsh, you can know, wow, these teachings have had a real effect on you. So it's the Eightfold Path that you're learning and you're dialing in closer and closer to your life to be able to then escape this discontentedness and escape this cycle of rebirth. This first spoke that is at 12 o'clock, this represents right view. This next one here is representing right intention. The 3 o'clock one is representing right speech. Then you've got right action. Then you've got right livelihood at 6 o'clock. You've got right effort. Then you've got right mindfulness at 9 o'clock. And then you've got right concentration. This is the Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And by studying this with the original words of the Buddha, you can see what he did teach and what he didn't teach. This Dhamma wheel that is here represented as what we call a temple marker, this marks out the main hall of the temple. Oftentimes, this Dhamma wheel is placed behind the head of a Buddha. So if you see a Buddha statue like here behind me, this is a temple that I take students on a tour. I lead these tours to forest temples and to temples in mountains and other places like that to help students understand the symbolism of the temples. You can see behind me there's two Buddha statues, and there's a Dhamma wheel right there behind the Buddha statue. So this is usually placed behind the head of a Buddha, either with statues like this, or you could see artwork where the artist has put this Dhamma wheel behind the head of a Buddha. And the reason why is because a Buddha has a flat spot in the back of their head, and this is where this Dhamma wheel is figuratively located. That when a Buddha awakens to enlightenment, this is a wonderful time for all of humanity, because as a Buddha awakens to enlightenment, now the wisdom to attain enlightenment is in the world, because there's an individual that embodies the wisdom that it takes for everybody to get to enlightenment. So it's said that when a Buddha awakens to enlightenment, that they reach up and they turn this Dhamma wheel counterclockwise. And as they're turning this counterclockwise, it's signifying humanity stepping forward, or all of civilization entering into a new era. Because when a Buddha awakens to enlightenment, that's the very best time to learn the teachings. If you live during the lifetime of a Buddha, you had to produce a significant amount of wholesome karma in your previous lives to live during the lifetime of an actual Buddha, because now the wisdom to get to enlightenment is profound and deep and shining in the world. Because what a Buddha does is they get to enlightenment by themselves without the help of any teachers or any guides. Then, once they awaken to enlightenment, they share their independently discovered teachings with countless people during their lifetime, and countless people get to enlightenment during the lifetime of a Buddha. And then they preserve their teachings in such a way that countless more people can get to enlightenment after their death. So these are the three main criteria that make a Buddha, is they get to enlightenment by themselves without the help of any teachers or any guides. That's why they have deep, profound wisdom. Then they share their teachings with countless people during their lifetime, and countless people get to enlightenment during their lifetime. And then they preserve their teachings in such a way that countless more people get to enlightenment after their death. And when a Buddha awakens, this is the best time for all of humanity, because now beings that are living during that time frame can learn directly with a Buddha and understand the deep wisdom that they share. So turning of this Dhamma wheel is kind of a figuratively thing that we say that humanity has stepped forward, or civilization has entered into a new era, because now there's a Buddha in the world that can share teachings that will help all of humanity to be able to get to enlightenment. So let me know what questions you guys have on this one. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So let's move on to the next one. This is a lotus flower. You'll see lotus flowers all throughout Buddhist culture and Buddhist artwork. You'll see them a lot of different places. You'll actually see real lotus flowers in temples that people are taking, and they're laying them at the feet of statues, or they're giving them to their teacher, they're giving them to an ordained practitioner or somebody like this. What a lotus flower does is, in the wild when it's growing, it's in a pond usually, kind of like a murky water of a pond, and its roots are deep down into the earth, the soggy, soft earth. And then it needs to grow this strong stalk to rise through the murky water. And then as it grows the strong stalk, it comes through the water and it rises over the water, and then it blooms into a lotus flower. And this is signifying your journey to enlightenment, because in the unenlightened state, the mind is holding on to the world, just like those roots of the lotus flower. It's holding on to the world. It's holding on to the earth. Then you need to grow a strong life practice, just like that stalk. You need to grow a very strong life practice of understanding things like the Eightfold Path and developing a meditation practice, among other things. And as you're growing that strong stalk, you're rising through the murkiness of the world. That water is the murkiness of the world, because the world is into all kinds of unwholesome things like killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, taking intoxicants. By the time you get to enlightenment, you're no longer conforming to what other people are doing around you. You're choosing through your wisdom to make wise decisions about how to conduct your life, where maybe in the past, if you were around other people and they started using profanity, you might just start using profanity too to kind of conform to what's going on around you. Or if other people are using drugs or alcohol, you might just start doing those kinds of things. But as your journey on the path to enlightenment, you realize that you're an independent practitioner who's looking to grow your wisdom, see the truth. You're not a follower. You're not a devotee. You're an independent practitioner who's looking for the wisdom. And through that wisdom, you're making wise decisions about your life. And you come to understand that lying and using profanity and using drugs and alcohol isn't going to produce beneficial results in your life. So an individual learns to move away from those things and no longer conform to society and what society's doing. You're looking to rise above that with your strong stalk, rising above this murkiness of the world. And then you bloom into this lotus flower where your mind is peaceful, calm, serene, and content with joy permanently for the rest of your life. So this is what an open lotus flower signifies, is enlightenment and your journey to enlightenment. When you see a closed lotus flower like this here, what this is signifying is your potential to get to enlightenment. And you'll typically see a lot of closed lotus flowers around Buddhist temples or in artwork. You see open lotus flowers as well, like at the bottom of a statue of the Buddha, they will sometimes engrave an open lotus flower, and then they'll engrave the statue right on top of that, signifying that the Buddha is enlightened. But if you see a closed lotus flower, this is signifying to you your potential to actually get to enlightenment. And just like not all lotus flowers rise above the water and bloom, not all individuals are going to be able to make their way to enlightenment. So here you can see this lotus flower down inside the water. It hasn't really made its way all the way out of the water, and it hasn't bloomed. So not every single lotus flower is actually going to bloom. Some of them will get stuck and they won't grow strong stalk. They'll be stuck down under the water. Some of them will break through the water, but they won't actually bloom. This is common, right? It's just like human beings, that some people will be on the path to enlightenment and they'll actually get to enlightenment. Other people, they won't, right? They'll make certain progress, but they won't actually get to enlightenment themselves. When we talk about a lotus flower rising above the murkiness of the water and blooming, well, when we talk about that, it's not to say that you should have conceit. When you get to enlightenment, if you think you're above other people, you're not enlightened yet. An enlightened being would consider themselves to be equal, like all people in the world. They don't see themselves above others. They don't see themselves below others. They're just equal to everybody in the world. So even though we talk about this as rising above the murkiness of the world, we're talking about making wise decisions to rise above the unwise decisions and the unwholesomeness that the world has. We're not talking about rising above people and putting yourself above people, because that would mean that there's still conceit in the mind and you would like to reside humble, where you're not viewing yourself as being above or below other people, but everybody's equal. So let me know what questions you guys have on this particular image. You can ask those questions in Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. All right, looks like Naresh, you have a question. Go ahead, sir. We can hear you a little bit. Your audio is still not as clear as it was the other day when we were talking. Okay. Maybe you can fix your audio again, Naresh, the way you did the other day when we were talking, and then we can come back to you.
Yeah, okay. Let's do that.
Okay, I'll go ahead and mute you for now, but if you could go ahead and fix your audio the same thing you did last time, then we'll be able to hear you more clearly. If anyone else has a question, you're welcome to ask that while we're waiting for Naresh. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom. Or in Zoom, you can raise your hand and ask any questions that you like. Okay, it looks like Mayuli is asking a question here. She says, the light that shines behind the Buddha's head in the drawing, is that the Dhamma wheel? Yeah, let me go back to that one. You can't quite see it probably if you're looking on Facebook, since you're on Facebook, Mayuli, but behind this, there's a white statue here where the pointer is. Then there's a gold statue that's standing up. Behind that gold statue, but behind the head, there's a Dhamma wheel that goes around in a circle here. It's very similar to this Dhamma wheel over here, and it's back here behind the head. If you went there to this temple, it's very clear to see, but the view of this photographer was pretty far away, so that's why you can't see it quite so clearly. I'm not sure if this is the picture I have in the book or not. I don't think I put this particular picture in the book, but if you would like to see this picture, I'm always pleased to send it to you. Just let me know through a private message and I'll send this picture to you. But yeah, it's right here behind the head of the Buddha. Okay. Naresh, you get your audio straightened out there? You have to unmute yourself once you get your audio situated. There you go.
Can you hear me?
Sure can.
All right. I forgot the question I was going to ask. Basically, you showed the lotus flower coming out and also the wheel. Why is it, because of what the world is like at the moment, why is it so hard to get enlightened? That's my question.
Sure. I don't think of it as hard to get enlightened, but I don't think about it as easy either. There's dedication, there's diligence, there's determination that an individual needs to do and apply in order to get to enlightenment. What people do that makes it more challenging for them is they don't learn with the original words of the Buddha. You need the true teachings of the Buddha in order to get to enlightenment. I've visited well over 200 temples throughout my life, and I've only ever been to one temple that shares the original words of the Buddha. That's less than 1%. So that tells you that there's a significant amount of people in the world who are considering themselves Buddhist that aren't actually learning with the original teachings of the Buddha. And this is the reason why people make it more difficult for themselves, that they don't understand that they need to get the original teachings of the Buddha. There's plenty of books out there. There's plenty of teachers. There's plenty of temples that are considering themselves Buddhist but they're not actually sharing the original teachings of the Buddha, because the Buddha started this as an oral tradition over 2,500 years ago. And it's mainly lived as an oral tradition all the way through this time. Even though there are books that document the teachings of the Buddha, the vast majority of the people don't have access to them, because these books, I actually have one of them right here. There's 45 of them. They're really thick. They're about maybe 10 centimeters thick, maybe about 4 or 5 inches thick. And these books, if you printed them all out here in Thailand, it would be equivalent to about 3 months of your salary. And I doubt you have any book collections that are worth 3 months of your salary. The average person doesn't actually have these. And even the average temple doesn't have these. So what I've done is I've consolidated this down into 13 books that you can download for free, because the average person doesn't have access to these books, not because anybody's been trying to hide the teachings of the Buddha, but we just haven't had the ability to share them far and wide, because mainly we've been printing off books for so long. But now with more and more people moving to the internet and being comfortable with electronic books, we can distribute them for free. So if somebody isn't learning with the original teachings of the Buddha, this is going to make it very difficult for them to get to enlightenment. And over that 2,500 years of time, people have slowly changed and modified his teachings. And this is what makes it difficult for people, because in an oral tradition, it's very easy for things to inadvertently get changed, or people might directly choose to change actual teachings. And this is very unwise. The Buddha warned against this. He advised people that it would be for their own detriment and their own harm, and for the harm of other people if they changed his teachings. Because one of the things that Buddha is doing during their lifetime is they're illuminating this path to enlightenment. It's like putting lights down along the sides of the path so that more and more and more people can see it. And then after a Buddha dies, as time goes on, impermanence affects these teachings. It's like people knock over the lights and gets really gray and very murky. So that's why what I do is I go back to the original teachings of the Buddha so that people can understand what he actually taught. And then I encourage you not to believe his teachings, but to investigate them, examine them, learn them, and then reflect on them to see that they're true, and then practice them so you can transform your mind. And that's where you'll know that you're studying the original teachings of the Buddha, because you'll see the improvement to the condition of your mind. So there's various things like this that people have made it more difficult for themselves. But once you get the original teachings and you're learning directly with a teacher that truly understands how to get to enlightenment, I don't consider it difficult, but I don't consider it easy either. Because what you're trying to do and what you're working to achieve is you're training your mind to eliminate its craving, desire, attachment. The mind wants to hold on. You maybe want to hold on to this lying, or you want to hold on to this profanity, or you want to hold on to these drugs and intoxicants, or you want to hold on to all these sensual desires that the mind is holding on to. And it's very painful for the mind to let go of a lot of these things. So the mind oftentimes gets in its way because it's holding on to so many things. And one of the last classes, or the last class that I'm going to teach as part of this group learning program, is called The Five Hindrances. I'm going to teach you the five things that hinder you from getting to enlightenment. Because throughout the 7-month program, I'm teaching people how to get to enlightenment. And then the very last class, I'm teaching people what's going to hinder them from getting to enlightenment. And there's various hindrances. And some of the ones that we just talked about are things that are obstructions for people getting to enlightenment. Okay. So Mayu Li has submitted an update here for her question. She wasn't referring to the picture that I was showing here with the statues and the Dhamma wheel. She was referring to the image of the Buddha that I use in all the various places where it's got this circle around the head of the Buddha. And she's asking, is that the Dhamma wheel? And the answer is no, this isn't a Dhamma wheel. What this is showing, the artist is depicting, is what we call an aura. That some people can see the aura of another person, and this is kind of what emits out of the head, if somebody is enlightened, then if someone is able to see a person's aura, then they can see this. Not everybody can see an aura, but if you can see it, this is what you might see for a being who is actually enlightened. So this artist is depicting that aura of the Buddha because he would have had a really big, bright, profound aura that is very visible to anybody who can see auras. Okay, so thank you for that update, Mayuli. Sorry I didn't understand when you first asked your question. Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions anywhere, so I'm going to move on to the next one, which is actually this one here. And the reason why I included this one into the book and I included into the class is that I actually ran across this as I was downloading images for this book and teach this class. I was looking at all the different imagery and symbolism that's out there and looking at the most common ones, and I ran across this one. And I thought this would be great to actually include into the book and into the class, because as you learn the different symbolism, like you just learned some of the symbolism with me, I just shared some of that with you, you're going to run across certain images, whether it's in artwork or whether it's in temples or books or other places, of things that I haven't taught you. So I haven't taught you this symbol, but I've taught you things that are similar to this symbol. So as you run across different symbols that you don't know and I haven't taught you, you can actually stand there and kind of think about what you do know about the teachings of the Buddha and what you do know about the symbolism, and you might be able to figure out what this symbol represents. And this is one of the fun things, one of the intriguing things about visiting various temples and seeing various artwork, is that you can kind of think about your teachings that you know. You can think about what is this artist trying to communicate, because that's typically what artists are doing, is they're trying to communicate some kind of meaning behind their artwork. And if you know some of the symbolism and if you know the teachings of the Buddha, you can oftentimes figure out what some of this symbolism is. So if you were looking at this image, based on what I've taught you so far, what would you think that this image represents? Well, when I asked this today at the temple, the students got it right away, is it represents enlightenment, right? Because here we've got that first symbol that I taught you guys, which I refer to as the Na, which is showing this journey to enlightenment. And then we've got an open lotus flower here at the top, which also signifies enlightenment as well. So the combination of these two things, it's very clear what the artist was trying to represent, which is enlightenment. So this is how you can take wisdom that you already know, certain things that you understand, and you can glean information from what the artist is trying to communicate. And of course, here I'm using very simple imagery, but when you see some of the artwork in the temples and different things, sometimes they're very complex and you can really look very closely and spot some of these things that the artist is trying to communicate. Now I'll share with you guys this particular image and this artwork. You'll typically see this one at the base of a temple stairs. Oftentimes there's stairs that lead up to a temple, and you can oftentimes see this image of this big large snake. This is me with a bunch of students and my son several years ago. This was before COVID, actually. This is a temple called Wat Doi Sutep, and there's these stairs, about over 300 of them, that lead up to the temple itself. And there's these big snakes right at the base of the stairs. And this is kind of a closer up version of that picture. And then over here, this is their ordination hall. And you can see here kind of a smaller version of this. So I'm going to share with you guys the story of this snake and why it's placed at the base of the stairs of a temple. And as I share it with you, I would like you to keep in mind that this story may or may not be true. I wasn't there at the time, so I can't confirm that it's true, but I can't confirm that it's not true either. It is in the original teachings of the Buddha. You will see this particular story in there. So let me share this story with you, and then I'll teach you how to extrapolate lessons from the story so that you can learn from it, so that you're not just understanding it as a story, but you're actually understanding the lessons that are embedded into the story. So whether it's true or false, it almost doesn't matter, because you're going to see these statues in a lot of different places, and you can actually glean information and glean understanding if you know the story behind it. So the story behind it is that this image represents this large snake that is oftentimes referred to as a naga, or some people refer to it as the king of the serpents. This is a very large snake. And according to the Pali Canon, there was this snake that was able to transition itself to look like a human during the lifetime of the Buddha. That there was this large snake that was so close to being reborn into the human realm that even in its existence as a snake, it could transition itself to look like a human being. And it's said that this snake made its way into the location where the Buddha was providing his discourses, where he was teaching his students. And this snake transitioned himself to look like a monk with a shaved head, with an orange robe and everything like this. And now this snake, who's now looking like a monk, went into where the Buddha was teaching with all the other ordained practitioners and was learning about the teachings that lead to enlightenment. And then what would frequently happen during the lifetime of the Buddha is that as the Buddha was talking in these very long, elaborate discourses, people would oftentimes fall asleep. Nowadays, if somebody fell asleep in a class, somebody might think that that's rude or disrespectful. I don't think that way. I've had students fall asleep in my classes. Some people come to the temple in order to sleep because they have difficulty sleeping at home, and they come and they sit all the way in the back of the class in a peaceful environment, and they feel like this is a comfortable place where they can sleep. So I welcome everybody. If they'd like to come in and sleep, let them come in and sleep, no big deal. So if people fell asleep during the lifetime of the Buddha understood, and I understand too, that the mind is working really, really hard in order to learn the teachings, and it can become exhausted sometimes as you're learning from a teacher in a course or a retreat or some kind of learning event. So as would frequently happen, as the Buddha was teaching this long, elaborate teachings, his students started falling asleep. And this particular being that had transitioned itself from looking like a snake to a human being had fallen asleep along with the other ordained practitioners. Well, as they were sleeping, they lost their mindfulness. They lost their awareness of mind. And now this snake transitioned back to looking like a snake and no longer looked like an ordained practitioner. And now one by one, as the ordained practitioners were waking up and they saw that they had this big, large snake amongst them, they had all this fear and they got very scared, and they went and got the Buddha. And the Buddha comes over because an enlightened being, they're not afraid. They don't have any fear. They've eliminated all fear whatsoever. The Buddha knows that he's not causing harm to this snake, so this snake's not going to cause any harm to him. So the Buddha comes over and the snake wakes up, and the Buddha asks, like, you know, what are you doing? And the snake's like, oh, I'm here to learn your teachings. I would like to get to enlightenment. And the Buddha's like, ah, okay. Well, unfortunately, you're not going to be able to get to enlightenment because you're a snake. And when you're in the animal realm, you can't actually get to enlightenment. But it looks like you're really close to being reborn into the human realm. So when you get to your next rebirth, then you can learn my teachings, and then you'd be able to get to enlightenment. And the snake's like, oh, okay, he understands, right? But then the Buddha asked the snake if he could leave because the human beings were very scared and very fearful because they're not enlightened yet. So they were scared and they were fearful. And he asked if the snake could please leave. And the snake agrees and he says, you know, I'll leave so that I don't cause any harm here and people don't get scared. So he says, although I'm going to leave, I'm going to go stand outside and I'm going to stand guard. And if anybody comes into your teachings and they have ill will, I'm not going to let them pass by. Having ill will towards the teachings of the Buddha would be to be interested in changing his teachings. If you try to change the teachings of a Buddha, you're causing harm to yourself and countless other people. And you would have to have a certain amount of ill will potentially in order to change the teachings of the Buddha. So this snake is said to be standing guard so that anybody who enters, they don't have ill will. So this is why the statue is placed at the base of stairs at a temple, because it's signifying this being who's standing guard. So now let's talk about some different lessons that you can take from this story. Because again, I don't know that this story is true, but I don't know that it's false either. Scientists tell us that 99% of the animals that once existed no longer exist anymore. That the animals that we see in the world, those represent only 1% of all the animals that once existed in the world. So whether this being existed in the past or not, I don't know. I've never personally seen a snake that can transition to look like a human, but I can't say whether that occurred during the lifetime of the Buddha or not because I wasn't actually there. But nonetheless, in this story, there's certain lessons that are embedded into it that you can actually understand and help you on your journey to enlightenment. The first one is that only humans and heavenly beings can actually get to enlightenment. If you're in the realm of hell, animal, or afflicted spirits, those lower realms aren't able to get to enlightenment. They need to be reborn into the human realm or the heavenly realm to be able to get to enlightenment. So an animal wouldn't be able to get to enlightenment. So one of the things you can think about when you pass by this snake on your way to a temple is say, thank goodness that you're human. This is the ideal existence that you can actually get to enlightenment. Thank goodness you're no longer in the animal realm. So this can kind of help you to appreciate this human existence and eliminate any complacency, where you can have determination, dedication, and diligence to developing your life practice and getting to enlightenment itself. The other thing that you can understand is that enlightened beings, they don't have fear, that there's no fear in the mind of an enlightened being, even the fear of their own death. They've eliminated all fear whatsoever. They don't even fear their own death anymore. And then the third thing that you can understand is that when you enter into a temple or you enter into an environment where you're learning the teachings of the Buddha, you shouldn't be interested in changing or modifying his teachings. That would cause you harm and would cause harm to the other people in the world as well. So these are the three things that you can keep in mind is that thank goodness you're human. You've made it to this existence. This is the ideal existence. Don't be complacent. Be motivated, encouraged, have enthusiasm to get to enlightenment. Understand that animals, they can't get to enlightenment in that existence, but they will be reborn potentially into the human realm at some point, and that's where they can get to enlightenment. So be appreciative that you got to this human realm and don't allow your mind to be complacent or dull or lethargic. Have that dedication and diligence to getting to enlightenment. And then the third thing is that don't have ill will towards the teachings of the Buddha, right? And ensure that you're not changing them or causing harm to yourself or others. And this will help you to remember these things, that you shouldn't have any fear whatsoever by the time you get to enlightenment. So let me know what questions you guys have. You can put those into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. Okay, looks like Naresh, you have a question. Go ahead, sir.
I don't understand what you mean by changing the Buddhist teaching, because we're going through the process of actually learning the Buddhist teaching through your book and possibly others as well. But how do you distinguish between the original, as you said, teachings and the ones that have changed? I don't understand how one person can see the difference, because, you know, I could be with another teacher at the moment, and he might have another way of actually not the Buddhist teacher. So how do you, not investigate, but how do you trust that source, because you can only go by what the teacher tells you. Like, I don't have access to the original teaching, so that I can't check them out. So, you know, I was trying to figure out how would somebody who's trying to learn and become like them,
sure,
use, you know, become, feel that he's getting the right teaching.
Sure. Let me help you with that. So, you have access now to the original teachings of the Buddha through the book series that I share. It's The Words of the Buddha, The Path to Enlightenment, Revealing the Hidden. There, these are excerpts from the Pali Canon, the original source teachings of the Buddha. But then you're encouraged not to believe these teachings, that you learn them, you reflect on them to independently verify them, and then you practice them to transform your mind. And what you'll notice is that the mind becomes more peaceful, more calm, more serene, more content, more joyful. You'll notice focus and clarity, concentration, deeper memory coming in slowly but surely. You'll notice your personal, professional relationships improving. These are all things that you'll know that are occurring because you're studying the original teachings of the Buddha. The way you cut through any impermanence or any changes is you study from the original source teachings of the Pali Canon, and then you don't believe any of those teachings. So all the books that I'm sharing with you and all the classes and courses and retreats, I'm basing everything that I share on the original teachings of the Buddha, and I show you his original words and I show you the reference back to the original source teachings. But then you're encouraged not to believe those things. So that's one way that you can ensure that you're studying the original teachings is you don't believe anything and you independently verify what it is that you're studying. And I'm going to show you how to do this if you've ever seen me walk through the Four Noble Truths or the Three Universal Truths or the Eightfold Path. I show students how to learn, reflect, and how to practice. And then if you ever see rites, rituals, ceremonies, or worship as part of what people are sharing as Buddhist teachings, then you know that those aren't the teachings of the Buddha, because he didn't teach any rites, rituals, ceremonies, or worship. So anybody who's sharing those kinds of things, they wouldn't have even been able to get into the first stage of enlightenment if they're still sharing rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship as part of the teachings of the Buddha. So you can consider that this person has misunderstood the teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha shares this himself. He says that if you ever hear somebody that shares something that's opposite of what he shared in his original discourses, that you could consider that this person has misunderstood his teachings and you can ignore that particular thing that that person is saying. So you can look at the original source teachings in the Pali Canon. You can look if there's rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship. Also, if you're studying with a teacher who deeply understands the teachings, you should see that that teacher's mind is clear and focused and concentrated, that they can articulate the teachings very clearly and very concisely and very precisely, because that speaks to the condition of their mind. If someone's mind is muddled, this means they're lacking concentration. This is guidance from the Buddha. He shares that this person hasn't deeply understood his teachings because the person's mind is still muddled. By the time that somebody is making their way to enlightenment and getting closer and closer to enlightenment, all that lack of concentration and focus and clarity, that's all gone. And you start noticing this focus and concentration and clarity coming into the mind in deep memory. Anything that a person is sharing in terms of teachings, they should be able to explain to you the why and explaining to you exactly why they're doing something. So, for example, if you're learning from somebody and they're teaching you to meditate and they're teaching you to observe your thoughts or label your thoughts or count or say pu to, pu to, pu to, or they teach you to listen to music, or there's these special beads that are being used, you should be able to ask them why. And now when you say why, they should be able to explain it, because none of those things that I just shared is actually what the Buddha taught, but you'll see these things often. What the Buddha taught for meditation is he taught to cut off your thoughts, to cut them off. And the reason why I'll share with you is because you're disciplining your mind. That in daily life, where you notice with mindfulness that your mind is longing, yearning, and chasing after something, you'll be able to cut that off and let it go. Or when the anger is arising, you'll be able to cut that off and let it go. And this is the ultimate goal of the path to enlightenment. So if you are sitting in meditation and somebody's teaching you to observe your thoughts, or they're teaching you to label your thoughts or count or listen to music, your mind hasn't actually let go in that situation. And that's the underlying problem in the unenlightened mind, is that it's holding on. If somebody teaches you that when you have pain in the body, to just breathe through the pain, well, this is a misunderstanding of the teachings of the Buddha, because the first 2 years of his life, he was actually doing things that were very painful to the body, like starving himself, hanging himself upside down from trees, piercing his body with metal implements, laying on beds of nails and things like this. And causing physical pain to the body doesn't produce enlightenment. But sometimes you'll see people that will teach you that when you're in meditation and you experience pain, to just breathe through it. And this is unwise. Or you'll see some people that will maybe teach that everybody has to be in exactly the same position for meditation. And there's a lot of emphasis on forcing the body to be in a particular position. Well, if this is the case, the individual hasn't understood the universal truth of impermanence, that things are constantly changing, that it's not possible for every single human body to get into exactly the same position. So these are a couple of things that you can look at to know that they aren't the teachings of the Buddha. But then the way you cut through all of that is you look at the condition of the mind of the teacher. You look to see if they're doing rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship, and you use the Pali Canon as your source, that you should be able to trace back the things that are being taught to this original source. And then you don't believe that. You investigate it. You reflect on it to independently verify it, and you practice it. And as you see the improvement to the condition of your mind, you'll know that those are the teachings of the Buddha.
but I understand where you're coming from. But as you said, when you actually read the original, it's very hard to read the original because it's like a repetition stuff. Like I've got a book once and I tried to read the original and I couldn't figure it out. But what I'm trying to say is that even in them, there is symbolism and talk about, like as you said, the snake and stuff like that. And so there are bits in there which doesn't seem believable. But do we just concentrate on the teaching, like the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and the Five Hindrances to understand the symbolism, the deity, the ghost, the different realms and stuff like that? So, you know, that's one thing I do have problems with, like understanding the different types of, like, you know, having deities and ghosts and talking snakes. But are they just simply the, like, something that you take and understand it and think that, okay, this is what it is, and you know, the symbolism is not that important?
Okay, so what I encourage you to do, Naresh, is to dive into the books that I share, because I've updated the word choices in all the books that I share, and I share it in a way that is easy for the common individual to understand. When I wrote these books and when I updated the word choices of the translations from the original source teachings, I kept in mind that the average person who might be reading these books may not be a native English speaker. So I wrote them in a way that uses very basic, very common English. So it sounds like the translations that you're using, that you're not able to quite understand what it is that you're reading. So I would encourage you to first start using the books that I write, which starts with volume one. Start with that volume first. And then you were saying that what you're reading, and you didn't reference reading the things that I've shared, but other people, you've referenced that what you're reading is very hard to believe. Remember, I encourage you not to believe anything at all. Belief will not get you to enlightenment, because with belief, you don't know what's true or false. You don't know whether it's true or false because you're just believing it because you were convinced through writings or through a teacher to just believe something. But belief doesn't get you to enlightenment. You're looking to get to wisdom. You would like to know what the truth is. So that's why you're learning something, you're reflecting on it to independently verify it, and then you're practicing it in order to train your mind and transform the mind. I know you're coming in here at the end of this program, which is fine. There's plenty of people who do that. When we restart on March 17th, that's where I'm going to start from the very beginning. And then you'll be able to see how I walk you through and I build you up piece by piece by piece using the core teachings. Here you're coming in on the end and you're hearing about the cycle of rebirth and snakes transitioning themselves to look like different things and all this stuff. This isn't the core central teachings of the Buddha, what I'm sharing right now. This is all the way at the back of the book. And you also referenced deities when you were talking. There are no deities in the teachings of the Buddha that you need to worship or make offerings to or do ceremonies or things like this. That's not what the teachings of the Buddha are about. It's about cultivating your wisdom, transforming your mind, uprooting pollutions, training your mind, honing your mind, and getting your mind to perform optimally. So you'll see this when you learn, starting from the beginning of the group learning program.
Okay, yeah. I'll go through the videos again on YouTube, and before March, I'll try and get through them and get your book and read it. You said you've got 7 volumes, and then you've got 7 books or something, or is it just one book?
It's actually 13 books, but I encourage you to start with the first book. And when someone's first getting started like this, there is so much information out there that it can often be overwhelming and confusing. So I encourage students for the first few years to study with the resources that I share, because if you're mixing and matching things from other teachers, even from within the same tradition of Buddhist teachings, it can get very confusing because people use different words to represent different things. But if you kind of standardize on one set of collection of teachings and resources, then you can make real progress in your journey to enlightenment. So while whatever you've done in the past has led you up to this point, I would encourage you to focus on the books, the videos, the podcasts, the audiobooks, the classes, courses, retreats that I share, because I know what I'm sharing will definitely lead you to enlightenment, but you need to get some time to really soak into those teachings so that you can see the truth for yourself. Whereas if you're mixing it with a bunch of other things, you'll get really confused. Like I saw the first part of a video today by a very well-known filmmaker and someone who's very well-known in the Buddhist community in terms of YouTube and stuff like that. And these people get hundreds and hundreds and thousands of views, even millions of views. And when I was watching it, every single thing they were sharing was completely opposite and contrary to the teachings of the Buddha. It wasn't actually what the Buddha taught. But yet there was this well-known filmmaker and this person who's a Buddhist monk who people have seen quite a bit on YouTube, and what they were sharing wasn't actually the original teachings of the Buddha. So it can get very confusing if you're digesting lots of content from different people. But if you can get confidence enough to standardize on one collection of resources from one teacher, that is what will help you to build a real foundation and a real nice framework to be able to understand the teachings and make real progress on the path.
Oh, I've only found one of your books on your site. So are you going to then publish the other book later on?
I have all 13 books published, but I only have one that's in audiobook format because it takes an extensive amount of time and resources to make an audiobook. So what I decided was, as I was finishing up my first audiobook and seeing how much time and effort it took and how much resources it took, I also noticed that AI was coming along, and I noticed that they're starting to have technology that can take a book in PDF format and then they can produce an audiobook pretty easily. So I let my son know, because he's probably going to be sharing these teachings as well, and I said, hey, you guys can use AI to do the audiobook for volumes 2 through 13, where I'm just going to do volume 1, because it took me over 6 months just to do the audiobook for volume 1. So I can imagine if I did all 13 volumes, which I don't mind spending 5, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years to do it, but it would take a significant amount of time, and that would take me away from spending time with students, doing one-on-one appointments, teaching in classes, teaching at the temple. So because I'm prioritizing my time with students, I know that the books for volumes 2 through 13, if somebody would like an audiobook, they can just use AI to generate that. It's really the first book that's really important to be sure that as you're first getting started, that as many resources as possible are available. So that's why I did the audiobook for that.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Okay, I'm not seeing. Oh, okay, here we go. We have another comment from Mayuli. She says, just want to share that my grandfather who passed away, when he was alive, he dedicated most of his life to the teachings. Now that I know, what he was practicing was not 100% the actual words of the Buddha. It's very unfortunate. Yeah, you know, that's the karma, right? That is what an individual experiences. But, you know, even in those teachings where it's not 100% the true teachings of the Buddha, somebody's not going to be able to get to enlightenment there, but maybe he learned to be a bit kinder. Maybe he learned to not lie or steal or some other thing, right? Like we all did those things kind of growing up, but he got some kind of benefit out of those teachings. So if I was you, I would look at the positive side. But now at this point in time, this is a wonderful time for people to learn the teachings of the Buddha because they can really shine in the world in a way that they haven't before. And your grandfather, having lived during the lifetime that he lived, he gained whatever benefit he gained. And then maybe he got to enlightenment at death, or maybe he's been reborn into another human existence or some other existence, and he'll continue his journey to potentially getting to enlightenment. Okay, so now I'm going to move to the next one, which this is the actual last one of the symbolism of the teachings that I'm going to share with you guys. This picture in the middle, this is a picture of the tree, which is attributed to where the Buddha attained enlightenment. during the lifetime of the Buddha, he knew he was going to die 3 months before he actually died. He made his students aware that he was going to die in 3 months. This is how awake he was. This is how enlightened he was, that he could see the future, and he knew that he was going to be dying in 3 months' time. So he wisely gave a heads up to his students, because anybody who might have been attached to him, this would be an ideal time for them to let go of those cravings, desires, attachments. And one of his students, his close student Ananda, said to the Buddha, "Hey, well, when you die, you know, what are we going to do? We've got all these people who travel from all over the world to come see you, and you're not going to be here. You're going to be dead. What should we tell them? What should we say?" And the Buddha says, "Oh, well, anybody who would like to travel to come and build their determination, their dedication, and their diligence, they can visit these four sites, and this would help arise dedication and diligence and determination in their mind. They can visit the site where I was born. They can visit the site where I attained enlightenment. They can visit the site that I delivered my first discourse, my first teaching, and they can visit the location where I actually died." So the Buddha said that this tree could be attributed to the location where he attained enlightenment. But keep in mind that he attained enlightenment over a 6-year journey. It wasn't instantaneous. The reason why he attributed this tree to his enlightenment is that after he attained enlightenment, he spent 7 weeks at this tree. And he contemplated whether or not he should share his teachings into the world or not, because his teachings were so radically different than what anybody else was sharing at that time. So he wasn't quite sure whether or not he was going to go back to the palace and assume life in the royal family, or was he going to go share his teaching? So for 7 weeks, he kind of contemplated at this tree about what he should do. Well, we understand what he actually chose to do, which was share his teachings. But this tree is still there today and honored and respected. And it's a national site in India that you can visit. And this tree is attributed to the location where the Buddha attained enlightenment. But it's not like 1 minute ago he was unenlightened and now this minute he's enlightened, and it was at this tree that occurred. That's not how enlightenment works. As you gradually get closer and closer to enlightenment, and the qualities of enlightenment start shining through more and more. So this particular tree is a symbol of enlightenment because it's attributed to the location where the Buddha attained enlightenment, even though he did it over a 6-year journey. So this leaf that you have here that I'm showing you, this is the shape of the leaf of that particular tree. This tree is often referred to as a Bodhi tree, but in the book, I gave you a whole bunch of other names. I gave you the scientific name. I think it's called Fictitious religialis, I think is the way it's pronounced. But there's a couple different names for it, depending on whether you're referencing the scientific name or just the common name. Commonly, people refer to it as a Bodhi tree. In the shape of this leaf, you can see where this kind of little kind of antenna kind of thing, this is kind of like a symbol of enlightenment, the whole shape of the leaf, and then kind of going off to enlightenment here, where the mind rises to this higher consciousness. So whenever you see this shape of this leaf, either in artwork, or I've seen it on the walls of a temple, I've seen bells that are made out of this shape, this is signifying enlightenment. That's what it's there for. So you'll see this in different venues and different places. And you can actually go visit this tree. The temple that I teach at, they actually have this tree too. It's not the same exact tree, of course, because there's only one location where this tree exists, but the same exact type of tree is at the temple where I teach. And on the ground, you can actually see the leaves for this particular tree. And you can see it, like I mentioned, in artwork and other places as well. So let me know if you guys have questions on this particular imagery and this symbolism. Okay. I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So what I'm going to do is just thank all of you guys for joining for today's class. Next week, I'm going to be in chapter 24, which chapter 24 is titled Misunderstandings of the Teachings. This is where you're going to learn a lot of the misunderstandings that exist in the world, because now we've kind of brought a little bit of those up through talking here, and Naresh was asking questions about those. I'm going to go through a lot of the common misunderstandings so that as you're going about the world, whether it's at temples or reading books or other things that you might come across, you can understand what are the common misunderstandings of the teachings of the Buddha. And I'm going to show you how to independently verify that, because while I share with you the commonly misunderstanding teachings, and these are based in belief, I'm not interested in you believing me that these are misunderstandings. I'm going to show you how to independently verify that these things that I'm going to share with you are indeed misunderstandings, so that you're not believing me, but you're not believing those things either, but you can come to the truth and fully understanding what are the teachings of the Buddha. Because one of the ways to help you get to enlightenment is to share with you what are the teachings of the Buddha. And that's what I've been doing for 7 months in this program. But another way is to show you what the teachings of the Buddha aren't. Because by sharing with you what the teachings of the Buddha aren't, then when you run across those things, you'll understand that. So there's a chapter devoted to this. It's called Misunderstandings of Gautama Buddha's Teachings. And you'll see this in chapter 24. And I'm going to walk you through and teaching you this next week in our class on Sunday. And then on Wednesday, I'm going to be doing guided meditation with you guys and opening up to any and all questions that you guys might have related to the teachings of the Buddha. So you're always welcome to come to that class for a guided meditation and then ask any and all questions that you like. And keep in mind that these classes are all recorded. So if you miss class for any reason, you can watch the recording on YouTube, on Facebook. You can also listen on our podcast, and you can get access to the teachings that way. Or if you've even attended the class and you'd like to just listen again or watch again, you can use those places to access the actual class. So thank you again for joining for today's class, and perhaps I'll see you guys in one of these future classes. We'll see you next time. Sawadee.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To provide support for this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha. To access more teachings, visit buddhadailywisdom.com. There, you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Remember, to establish a daily, consistent meditation practice, along with learning and practicing these teachings, a well-developed meditation practice is the foundation in which to train the mind to attain enlightenment.